is this really our Joseph? You know, our whiter than white Joseph who resisted the clutches of Potiphar's wife and he went to prison rather than do the wrong thing. Joseph of the amazing technicolour coat. Joseph the dreamer. Is it really him doing all this? Or doing what? Pulling this World Bank stunt and single-handedly inventing third world debt. What do I mean? Well, look at the progress of this chapter. We're into the years of famine here, and in verse 13, the famine is severe, and you see there in verse 13, Egypt and Canaan languished. That is, they were having a bad time. So in verse 14, Joseph sells grain to the hungry Egyptians. Now that is not too surprising. I mean, we might never read this chapter, but the story as it goes on is a fairly familiar one. In chapter 41, the Pharaoh has his dreams. That's familiar. You remember seven thin cows coming up and gobbling up seven fat cows? And in all of Egypt, only Joseph can make sense of the Pharaoh's dream. So Joseph is hauled out of prison, he's given a bath and a haircut, and plonked in front of Pharaoh, and he spells it out, God has revealed in this dream that there will be 7 years of abundance followed by 7 years of famine. Now, this is one of those wild climatic cycles that we know so well from things like the last 10 years, except that this time there is no rain here in the eastern Mediterranean or down here in the highlands of Ethiopia. So there's no rainfall and there's no Nile flood. No Nile flood, no food. And all completely without the aid of greenhouse gas emissions or Kyoto protocols or anything. They're having these wild fluctuations. But you remember too that not only did Joseph announce the doom, he gave Pharaoh the solution too. Chapter 41, verse 34. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land to take one-fifth of all the produce of the land of Egypt during the seven plentiful years, and let them gather all the food in these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh was so impressed when Joseph explained this that he decided to let the man with the vision have the job. So for the next 7 years, we read, Joseph gathered up all the food of these 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt. Then when the famine bit, we read, so when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. Now that's simple enough. And then you see what happens, verse 14 in our chapter. Through all of this selling, Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan in exchange for grain. Yeah, whatever prices he is selling at, he is dealing in a scarcity market, so he just rakes it in. Under those circumstances, Joseph, looking at the famine, is a bit like Grumman or Lockheed, looking at the prospect of a new war breaking out in the Middle East or somewhere else in the world. Oh, goody, you know, sales will come. But these are the years of famine, and the farmers who are handing over their hard-earned coins for food, they have nothing growing. So these Egyptian farmers are not going to be able to earn any money to replace what they've spent. So as the famine wears on, we get to verse 15. When the money was all spent in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us food, why should we die before your eyes, for our money is gone. So Joseph makes them mortgage their livestock to the Pharaoh. Verse 14, horses, flocks, herds, donkeys, in exchange for food. Now, when the bad years end and these farmers go back into production, the Pharaoh now owns all the means for ploughing and grinding and transporting stuff to market. You see the path that this is taking. There is a drought, times are tough, so I sell my livestock and I take out a loan, but I am still not in production. You know, this is now a debt that I will never be able to pay off. Then you get verse 19. Buy us and our land for food. We with our land will be servants of the Pharaoh. Now, servants in our translation is a polite way of saying slaves. So by verse 24, the land, the means to work the land, and the lives of the people themselves are all in hock to the Pharaoh. And for the privilege of working on the Pharaoh's newly acquired farmland, the people of Egypt now get to pay a levy of 20% of their production to the Pharaoh in perpetuity, just to make sure that they can never save up enough to buy their land back or buy their livestock back. Now you notice, straight from the modern world, Joseph's emergency measures back in chapter 41, like all emergency measures, have now turned into permanent rules. And Joseph did it to them. Now, why do I get so steamed up about that? I do, I know. One time a friend said to me, "What did Joseph ever do to you? You know, why are you going on about him?" Well, partly because I read this and there are too many parallels to our own age, too many parallels to the 21st century. I mean, we know about rural debt in New South Wales. We know about the horrible effects that it has on people's lives. In West Africa, we have whole countries who are in the same position as Joseph's Egyptians, sort of having to split their GDP between buying weapons for the colonel who is in charge and, on the other hand, servicing part of the interest on a foreign debt that is going to go on into the infinite. And then you see the way Egypt gets rigged so that the privileged class of priests manage to stay aloof from all of this. Verse 26, the priests don't have to pay the levy. The priests get private, you know, they get funded by the Pharaoh. Now that is just too much. You know, here they are, these low-life individuals, the leaders of the most expensive and least productive industry in all of history, the priests, they escape the poll tax and their own lands don't get touched. By the end of the famine, there is a tiny ruling class who own everything, and there are a mass of workers in permanent debt and feudal obligation. That is just too much like the 21st century. But it's worse than that. I mean, I say that kind of thing, but we look at verse 25 and we say, well, what are you complaining about? He saved the Egyptians from starvation, didn't he? Better to be a slave than to die. And I tell you, the commentators tie themselves in knots, homing in on verse 25 and try to make out that good, kind, innocent Joseph was a fine fellow and he did the right thing by the Egyptians. Commentators will often rabbit on about slavery in the ancient world not being so bad after all. Well, they haven't tried it recently, have they? Jolly old John Calvin. Wonderful John Calvin. In his commentary on Genesis, he flies the Protestant work ethic flag. It was good and right for Joseph to sell the Pharaoh's grain to the people. After all, Joseph was only a public servant. And if he didn't sell the grain at a good price, he would be letting down his king. Besides this, this was the grain that the people had sold to the Pharaoh, and now it's only fair to sell it back at a price. But you stop there and you see the twisted cleverness of Joseph's mind. Joseph hadn't bought the grain from the people in the first place. In chapter 41, he levied it. He commissioned workers to go through the farms of Egypt and collect it by royal decree. But even the plan to do that wasn't Pharaoh's plan, dumping it on Joseph. It was Joseph's. Joseph invented the plan. Joseph executed it, setting out 14 years before to collect, free of charge, huge reserves of grain that he now sells back to the people who grew it in the first place. And it's not even value added to justify some kind of price hike. Everything that the Pharaoh gets out of the deal is pure profit. No wonder Pharaoh loves Joseph. This Joseph really is the son of Jacob. And verse 25, Joseph saves the Egyptians, but at what cost? But it was the only way, wasn't it? what was it? Collect up the grain and then sell it back at a profit. This long story of Joseph takes chapters and chapters in the book of Genesis. Who were the people who read it when it was first written up? You think, it was the ancient Israelites, wasn't it? After God had rescued them from Egypt centuries after. What did God tell the ancient Israelites about providing for hungry people? About dealing with poverty and debt? You remember the laws in the Old Testament books of Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers. In Exodus, among the Israelites, no slave was to serve in perpetuity. No slave was to serve more than 7 years. After 7 years, they were to be set free. Free of debt. And Deuteronomy adds, you shall furnish him liberally out of your flock, out of your threshing floor, and out of your winepress. In Leviticus, among the Israelites, you have this marvellous jubilee thing that they had. After 50 years, all debts are written off. And any land that has been sold reverts to the family that owned it in the first place. That's not much like Joseph's permanent debt program, is it? And hunger and poverty in Israel? In Leviticus, when the Israelites harvested their fields or their vineyards, they were supposed to leave produce around the edges that could be collected by people who had no land or people who were on tough times. They weren't supposed to set up a little turnstile or a sort of a collection booth at the entrance and charge a fee as people went in. In Exodus, every seventh year, God told the Israelites to let their farms lie fallow. And that everything that grew by itself was available for people in hardship to come and collect. No charges applied. Or that famous tithe. The tithe that God told the Israelites to put aside in the book of Deuteronomy. That gets preachers so excited when they want to talk about money. In normal years, the Israelites were supposed to collect up their tithe, this is the Israelites, a tenth of everything that grew on their farms, and take it, and have a huge slap-up feed in celebration of God. But every third year, the whole tithe was stored up and handed over to people who were landless, or poor, or hungry. And on it goes. God spelled it out for the Israelites over and over that the idea was grace, generosity, looking after each other the way that he had looked after them. But the point is this, all those laws about fields and food aid and sharing and that sort of thing were given to the Israelites as they were on their way out of Egypt. Every Israelite who ever read the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis had those ideas of jubilee and liberty and generosity hammered into their brain. See, what does that do to Joseph? What he does saves Egypt from starvation. But the way he does it, it's shrewd, it's cunning, it's underhanded. In fact, it's downright un-Israelite. This is not the way you would treat an Israelite, or at least not the way you were supposed to treat an Israelite. It's not the way God taught the Israelites to deal with poverty and difficulty. It's more like an arms manufacturer watching President Bush getting warmed up for battle and rubbing their hands with glee. When the ancient Israelites read the story of Joseph and the Egyptians, what would they have done? You think about it. Would they throw up their hands in horror and say, how terrible, that is not the way we are supposed to deal? Actually, I think they'd have a good laugh. They'd say, how clever, what a great way of putting these Egyptians in their place. See, at the end of our passage, verse 27, Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen. They gained possession of it. If we go to the, yep, there it is, up here. The Israelites get one of the best bits of Egypt to go and live in, where the rest of Egypt was sinking into debt because they have their favourite brother now on the front bench in Egypt. There is nepotism, if ever there was one. Look after your family. But the Israelites, from their point of view, the whole story of Joseph, from beginning to end, makes the Egyptians look daft. Makes them look stupid. Think about it. The Egyptians, in the ancient world, are supposed to be the great dream interpreters and the mystics. But the one time in their history that their pharaoh has a real message from God in a dream, can the Egyptians work it out? Now they have to send for a grubby Israelite prisoner to help them. Egypt is the breadbasket of the Mediterranean. Growing and storing food is their thing. So much food is stored up in Egypt that they can afford to waste their time on building pyramids and things. And storing food. You remember how the Egyptians love their cats? Why are Egyptians so obsessed with cats that they even mummify them? Because they are into storing food for the long term. I mean, mice are pests of stored grain, aren't they? Cats are a wonderful thing if you are an Egyptian. They mean that you can eat. When it comes to a real food storage situation, though, like this one that Joseph deals with, the Egyptians can't handle it. Joseph is the only one with the plan to do it. The Egyptians are sharp dealers. They are rich, they are powerful, they are famous for their gold and their wealth. But when it comes to dealing, Joseph outmaneuvers them from the start and they haven't got a hope. But Joseph and his family get the best bits of Egypt. At every point, the mighty Egyptians look stupid. You think about it, you're an Israelite. You read this, your great and powerful enemies, the Egyptians who stomped on your forefathers, and look at Joseph making fools out of them. And as an Israelite, you're cheering on the action, and you're laughing and you're clapping while the Egyptians are sent up. But while you laugh, that says something about you as well. See, as an Israelite, how are you supposed to think about these Egyptians, these foreigners? These outsiders, these aliens. Think of the promises God made to Abraham. Genesis 12, I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. In you all the families of the earth will be blessed. How is all of that going in the time of Joseph? Well, in the time of Joseph, there are 70 Israelites now, so they are on their way to becoming a great nation. Their name is great. Their name is so great that Pharaoh is terribly pleased to meet Jacob at the beginning of this chapter. And they get blessed all right. Safe from famine, little brother on the front bench in Parliament, best pasture land in Egypt. God has blessed them. What about blessing for the nations? In you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. In a way, Egypt is blessed because they're safe from famine, having Joseph there. It's a bit murky as a blessing, isn't it? This is not clear-cut blessing for the families of the earth that God promises to Abraham. In reality, three generations down from Abraham, Joseph is playing games with the nations. Games that the Israelites will richly enjoy reading about for centuries to come. But at what expense? Israel cannot have God's promise of blessing for all the nations and keep up a manic, nationalistic xenophobia at the same time. If we are in this story, where are we? We're the foreigners, we're the outsiders, we're the Egyptians. We are the ones locked out of Israel, selling our blocks of land in order to buy bread. We're the Gentiles selling ourselves as slaves to Pharaoh so that we can eat tonight. So what about God's promises? Blessing to the nations. We drive on from Joseph through the Old Testament, and Israel only ever becomes more exclusive than this. In fact, where doing any good to the nations is concerned, this is the absolute high point of Old Testament Israel. It never gets better than enslaving these Egyptians. But there is a promise of something else. You read the Old Testament, Isaiah the prophet looks forward to the time when the nations will come streaming in to hear the word of God. In Isaiah, God says about the Messiah, "It is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light to the nations. I will that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth." And then you read on, what does Jesus say when he turns up in the New Testament? "I am the light of the world." There you go. Light for the nations. Jesus fulfills it. In John's Gospel, when some Greeks, some Gentiles like us, some foreigners turn up wanting to see Jesus, it's at that point that Jesus says, "Now the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. The moment is here for a light to all the nations, not just the insiders." And what is it that Jesus says at the very end of Matthew's Gospel? Famous words, "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations." You know, you could multiply that with examples all the way through the New Testament. But the idea is that Jesus is not like Joseph. With Jesus, unlike with Joseph, the promise of God through Abraham is fulfilled. Through Jesus, there is blessing for the nations, for Gentiles like us, as well as for Israelites. Through Jesus, people of any nation, people of any background can turn back to God and know his love. Through Jesus, people from any ethnic group can put their trust in him and have his forgiveness. No boundaries. And it's interesting, you think about the New Testament, there is a parallel that the great famine relief program in the New Testament that we read about. You remember Paul making a collection for the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem. In the book of Acts, in 1 Corinthians, in Romans, Paul, as he goes round the Mediterranean world, collects up a huge gift to be able to help buy food for Jewish Christians back in Jerusalem. So he's collecting for whom? Sorry, from whom? From Gentiles. For whom? For Jews. Gentiles who knew God's blessing, passing it back to those who were part of Israel. Paul's collection in the New Testament, in a lot of ways, it's like the mirror image of Joseph's scheme in the book of Genesis. But with Paul in the New Testament, what strings are attached? How much do the Jews pay to be fed? Not a sausage. It's all a free gift of love. It's the absolute opposite to Joseph. So what do? With this story of Joseph? What do we do? Do we read it as a sort of economics textbook, justifying some kind of theory of how we ought to do business in this world? No. We read it as a story of isolation, a story of walls between nations, a story of Israel's national glee at Egypt's discomfort, a story where the barriers of nationality and ethnicity and suspicion and manipulation are all up. But in spite of that, a story where God still manages to benefit these Gentiles. But in the great flow of the Bible, it's a story that is pointing forward to the time when those barriers come down, when God's promises find their proper fulfillment, when God's promise of blessing to Gentiles like us comes clear in Jesus. And in that, when we read Joseph, we ought to be reminded that God's promises are global. We live in New Testament times. We live in the age when the gospel is going out into all the world. And our role isn't only to wind up like Joseph, hoarding up the advantage to ourselves, or possibly to our Pharaoh, but to think globally and see that the gospel does go out. All the more in our current climate of growing suspicion and nationalism as our lords and masters whip us up into periodic frenzies of war fever. People of all nations, they're the ones that God wants to bless through the gospel of Jesus. The task of our time is to be involved in that. The task of our time isn't with Joseph, it's with Jesus. Now do a bit of imagining with that. You imagine, think, dream. Imagine we all dropped the Joseph kind of nationalism. Hooray for our people, let's sell these Egyptians into slavery. Imagine the gospel of Jesus doing its work and breaking down the barriers of suspicion and national pride and putting down the other side. Imagine the gospel going forward. Imagine, for example, in Syria, President al-Assad and all his nasty little clique put their trust in Jesus and turn around and live for him. What would that do to the terror of the Ba'ath Party in Syria? Or play the same game in your imagination for Iran, or North Korea, or, say, Sudan. Imagine Osama bin Laden and his appalling friends turning around to the gospel of Jesus and living for him. Imagine the executives of Grumman and Lockheed and other major armaments manufacturers turning around to live for the gospel. What would that do to the world armaments trade? Imagine all the presidents and prime ministers of this world turning to Jesus, living for him. People in every place, in every culture. Well, I say I'm a dreamer. But this time, it's God's dream, isn't it?